Thank you very much for joining us this evening. I really, really, really appreciate your presence. And what an appropriate environment to have a faculty lyceum where we are considering one of the central topics of the conversation of the ages, seriously, as we're surrounded by these figures and representations of many others who have been a part of and who have contributed to that conversation. So as we begin, please join me in prayer. Our good Father, we thank you for your goodness and your grace as we come together tonight to think about important matters in our lives. I pray that you would grant us discernment and wisdom and courage to seek that which is true, to believe it, and to live according to it. And so may the meditations of our heart and the fruit of our lips be pleasing in your sight through Christ. Amen. Amen. So again, thank you for joining us this evening. Really, really grateful as we reflect together. Now, those of you who are standing at the back, there are three empty chairs right up here. Please make your way straight on up if you would like, before I get too wrapped up, before I get going too strong. Actually, I see another one right there. So there are three, four chairs right on up here. So don't hesitate to make your way on up. Now, I want us to think together tonight. And yes, I want you to think, not just passively listen. I want you to think together with me about something that we all recognize and acknowledge as very, very important, namely education. Education is important individually, in individual lives. It is important in families. I have had the honor at the college level, at the seminary level, and in fact, now at the secondary, middle school and secondary level, of being a part of families educating children, youth, and young adults in families where they were the first generation from that family to go to college or seminary. And that is a tremendous honor. It really is. And I quake in my boots often at the responsibility that that brings. Education is important regionally as well. Nationally, economically, philosophically, culturally, socially, emotionally for individuals, psychologically for individuals, and of course, professionally. In fact, that last point needs no discussion because most of our educational philosophy and practices have moved in the direction of being vocationally oriented. In other words, preparing and helping people to get a good job. And there's nothing wrong with that. I'm very supportive of vocational education, as a matter of fact. My students might be surprised to hear that. Not as surprised as they are when I tell them I'm very supportive of parentally arranged marriages. But in fact, I am. That shocks them a little bit more. So I think few of us, right, would deny any of these claims about the importance of education. To be more specific, though, because we're not going to talk about vocational education tonight. And I, again, thumbs up to vocational education. Let's just call it what it is, though. Something very distinct from education of the ages past and what I would call properly formative education. So I want us to think tonight more specifically about what constitutes the heart of proper education. Education worthy of deep sacrifice. Now, in order to set the stage, I will, in typical scholarly fashion, talk about something other than my main point most of the time. That's the way you play the game. Actually, it's very important. Because if you don't set the stage, then the impact and the preciseness of what you're saying can be missed. So I want to set the stage as deeply and carefully and compellingly as I can. But in the process of doing so, I want to make one primary point about, one foundational point about properly formative education, and then I will conclude my talk with a few comments about Christ pertaining to culture and education. Culture is the established patterns of life rooted in the world, in the way the world and our place in it is viewed, and thus our beliefs, our attitudes, our actions, and our artifacts. Now let me try and reduce that down to a more simple definition. Culture is the way we live and all the stuff that goes with it. That makes up culture. Culture is always in flux. It's never static. It's always dynamic. And it is virtually always pluralistic to a greater or lesser extent. In other words, we are more correct at any time and pretty much about anything to speak of cultures, plural, or coexisting subcultures. While dominant and common characteristics of corollary subcultures can be identified, there are equally clear distinctions which distinguish. Sometimes those distinctions can coexist without conflict, such as a rural or agricultural subculture and an urban or service-based subculture being right next to one another and interfacing with one another regularly, right? They coexist. They're very different cultures in many ways, subcultures, I should say, in many ways. But they enhance one another and they complement one another, and they recognize that, and so they coexist without conflict, largely. However, there are many times when those subcultures can't coexist. Instead, their mutual existence is characterized primarily by competition and conflict. Obviously, in our world today, we see that going on with what many people call radical Islam and virtually any other way of life. There is no coexistence, typically there. There is instead conflict. Perhaps a better point of reference for us, especially since we're thinking tonight about education, would be the differences in the subcultures of the youth and parents. Now, if your children are wee little lads at this point and lassies, you'll see that soon, right? And of course, you experienced it when you grow up. If we grew up in the modern West, those distinctions were pronounced between the youth and their elders. Now, this is interesting because we're talking about people who live within the same region, and if we're talking about children and parents, the same house. Engaged in many of the same extended activities, such as recreation, maybe church group, maybe friend groups, etc. And yet, looking at the world and their place in it very differently. Different aspirations, different ambitions, etc. And so, therefore, they have different values, they prioritize things differently, they have different ambitions, different aspirations, and thus different beliefs, different ways of acting, different ways of relating to one another. And of course, I see that all the time, and those with whom I serve see that virtually every day. Now, sociologists have long recognized a pattern when you have different cultures which begin to interface in some way or another. Subculture A or culture A comes into contact with culture B. And there's a pattern. And that pattern is typically when there is not outright conflict right up front. That pattern basically goes like this. Initially, you have accommodation. In other words, I agree to recognize you, allow you to live, do your own thing, maybe even respect you, coexist side by side with me, and I hope you do the same, right? We're going to accommodate one another. Second is acculturation. So after what we might call mutual acceptance, you have acculturation. This is where the interface begins to go a little further, but it's all external. For example, we have now a love in Texas of Tex-Mex, right? Mexican food. It's a regular part of our cuisine. That didn't used to be the case, necessarily. But it is now. So there's an example where you begin to embrace some of the external realities of culture B. Now, of course, it's sushi. I haven't learned that yet. But so there you have some acculturation where culture A begins to embrace certain external realities and practices and ways of being, ways of sustaining, et cetera, that culture B does. And so culture A embraces a lot of those and it begins to look a little different. But again, all of this is external. Stage three is what you might call assimilation. This is where you begin to see acceptances and an embrace and changes that are internal and foundational. In other words, you begin to embrace or adopt some of the attitudes and beliefs of culture B and culture B of culture A sometimes. Sometimes it's more dominant, right? Where one culture is doing that more. Sometimes it's by force. I think of the ancient cultures when the Greek civilization, the Greek culture took over the known world, followed by the Roman culture taking over the known world. By force, they imposed some of their culture, other parts of it by choice. So this is what we call assimilation. That is nearly always followed by amalgamation. This is when you have culture A and culture B, or one way or the other, or going mutually both directions, whatever the case might be. This is where you have such a deep embrace of some of the foundational and internal things, although the externals also add to it. It's not just internal. This is where you have an embrace of these things to such an extent that what emerges is actually a different culture, something very different. Now, there are ways in which it looks enough like it used to that you don't necessarily think of it as a different culture, but one day you wake up and say, what happened? I don't remember it being like this when I was a young man or a young woman, right? And of course, what we want is to be able to see what isn't there yet, because we've learned to see the impact of some of these things and where it will likely lead eventually. Now, with all that in mind, Sharon Dalloz Parks speaks of culture as mentor. Now, this is a very important point for my talk tonight. And I think she's dead right. Culture as mentor. Now, it is here, students, where I'm really focused on what I told you the other day in assembly I was going to talk about that consumes the vast majority of your waking life and probably many of your dreams also. Namely, culture as mentor. She notes, quote, "Every culture serves as a mentoring environment by mediating expectations of adulthood and the terms of faith. Culture as a word is closely related to the term cultivate or cultivation. A culture is composed of forms of life by which a people cultivate and maintain a sense of meaning, thus giving shape and significance to their experience." One could rightly speak of culture as a mirror of people's decisions and actions about the world and their place in it. But here's what we don't often think about. We don't think about it with regard to mirrors, and we don't think about it with regard to culture, and I want to encourage you to think about it. While people create and shape culture, more often people are shaped and created by culture. Now think about that for a moment, because that's a very important point for my concern about properly formative education. It's for that reason that we call ourselves at the Cambridge School of Dallas and what we do countercultural. Now, I want to be careful on that, because that doesn't mean, you know, we want to stick our head in the sand and ignore the world. Quite to the contrary. Blake Woodall and I want to have a great time on this journey, don't we? We want to enjoy life and all the good things of culture, right? But we're still countercultural in a lot of ways. G.K. Chesterton famously stated that, quote, "Education is simply the soul of a society as it passes from one generation to another. Whatever the soul is like, it will have to be passed on somehow, consciously or unconsciously, and that transition may be called education," end quote. Now, while that's an oversimplified way of thinking about education, I think he's on to something. In this sense, according to Chesterton, the nature of a culture, now listen carefully here, the nature of a culture is constantly dependent upon the well-formed sensibilities, perceptions, and character of its citizens, and the faithfulness of those citizens to pass along to the next generation and to one's culture, generally speaking, to pass along those most foundational and formative understandings and commitments to life lived well, to life lived in harmony with the truth. And this conveyance from one generation to the next must be in both word and deed. It's not enough to spout a lot of sophisticated philosophies. It's not enough to just live in the world of ideas. But instead, we must learn to live like we say one ought to live. In his typically wry manner, Chesterton went on to note, quote, "What we need is to have a culture before we hand it down. In other words, it is a truth, however sad and strange, that we cannot give what we have not got, and cannot teach to other people what we don't know ourselves," end quote. In a related sense, though confessing very different commitments, in other words, Chesterton was an Orthodox Roman Catholic Christian. This next fellow I'm going to quote, whose name is Michael Mead, is not in any sense. At least that's my understanding. But he says, quote, "When the passionate, boundless energy of our youth is wasted through the failure of our culture to give meaningful direction and care, we all court disaster. Without elders who grasp and protect the mysterious nature, or excuse me, the mysterious core of culture, then inner purpose and spirit do not get valued and acknowledged by an appropriate community, and people feel like victims and act like outcasts, end quote. Now let me pause and just ask you, does that description perhaps ring close to home? I can't help but think it does. Now, as you may suspect, and rightly so, my concern within this talk is primarily about Christian presence within culture. Note that I did not say my concern is with Christian culture, because I don't think there is such a thing, this side of heaven, anyway. Not until the world is fully redeemed and recreated. There is no such thing as Christian culture. That's an important point, too. That doesn't mean there aren't Christian callings, Christian ideals, Christian commitments, Christian ways of being, Christian priorities. Yes, those are there, but always impurely, right? At this point. There can be, however, faithful Christian presence within culture, within any culture, within every culture. There can be faithful Christian presence. And in fact, that's the calling of Christ. And I would go on to say, here's a little hint at where all this is going. I would say that's the task of properly formative Christian education, to identify what that looks like as best we can and how we begin achieving it. What does it mean to have and maintain faithful presence as Christians within our culture? What does that look like? This is a perpetual question for serious followers of Christ. Believers have wrestled with this matter in deep and wide-ranging ways throughout the ages. You can go all the way back to the Old Testament Apocrypha. That is precisely one of the reasons many of those books were written, because they were wrestling with what does it mean to be faithful to our God in the midst of this strange culture. Of course, many others have wrestled with it along the way. Saint Augustine in his City of God, the Reformers, both the Lutherans and the Catholics, and the Anabaptists wrestled with this very type of question in many and deep ways, and they, of course, answered it in very different ways. In the last 50 years, what has characterized much of the brouhaha surrounding Christians, especially what we might call conservative or evangelical Christians? Culture wars. That question has been right at the front and center of it all. Lately, we have a lot more focus on this again amongst theologians, and not just theologians, but philosophers and thinkers. But to point out two Christian thinkers recently, Makoto Fujimura, the Japanese artist, and Andy Crouch, one of the senior editors of Christianity Today magazine, both have written influential books within the last decade. And they're calling for a less reactive, a less combative approach to culture, and a more creative, a more positively engaging, a more stewarding approach to culture. Frederica Matthews Green, an Eastern Orthodox scholar, she sort of throws her hands and hat up and says, tap the brakes. Culture is actually like the weather. You can no more change the culture than you can change the weather, she says. Oh, sure, you can seed the clouds and maybe make it rain a little more or a little sooner than it would have otherwise, but you don't really change the weather. So She's pretty set in her insurmountable, what would we call it, otherness, I guess you would. In the 1950s, a scholar named Richard Niebuhr wrote what is probably the standard work on this issue of Christ and culture, or Christian presence and culture. Nearly every serious discussion about Christ and culture revolves around Niebuhr's presentation. He posed five ways of understanding the relationship: Christ against culture, the Christ of culture, Christ above culture, Christ and culture in paradox, and Christ the transformer of culture. Now, a lot of scholars spend a lot of time trying to figure out which one of those is right. And I think that's kind of a wrong-headed way to go, because the fact of the matter is, all of them have some aspect of merit. But more importantly, these are different emphases of a greater whole. And so we ought not get caught up in trying to analyze this kind of relationship in these kinds of ways as though we're going to be able to come to some kind of exclusive final answer. Because just as sure as we think we've got it pinned down, got the pigeon in the hole, the pigeon comes out and flies to another hole. So we have to be careful there. Most recently, in the widely ballyhooed book, The Benedict Option by Rod Dreher, he calls for Christians to establish a parallel polis within their community or locale. Now, polis is the ancient Greek word which essentially meant city or way of being, way of mutually dwelling together in a common locale, the way it's governed, the way it runs, the way it sustains itself. It's a fairly multifaceted idea in many respects. Now, we get our word political from it, but don't confuse those two. They overlap, but there's as much distinction between them as there is overlap. So he is suggesting what Christians need to do is not run and hide from culture, but instead try and live within it, but live within it distinctively in such a way that we're creating sort of parallel ways of being. And we're still going to interface, we're still going to embrace that which is good, but there are distinctions that run definitively deep and therefore distinguish. Now, Dreher wants this to happen so that we can distinguish that parallel polis from the more dominant culture. This approach arises because of Dreher's description of the dominant culture in the modern West, in the U.S. in particular. And I spend a moment on this because this book has gotten a lot of attention. Dreher is literally speaking all over the world. In a year, it's already being translated into multiple languages. I mean, it has really become a significant influence. So he describes the dominant culture within the modern West as being overwhelmed in a flood of, quote, hostile secular nihilism, end quote, and uncompromisingly intolerant of Christian faith. Well, I don't want to worry so much about whether or not we would describe it in the same way, or I would describe it in the same way. I don't want to worry about that so much. But I do want to say he's not totally off his rocker, that's for sure. Our broader culture has, in fact, come under the spell of a hypermodern, or postmodern, if you want, promise of fulfillment, individual and societal fulfillment, from the false promises of an allegedly liberating autonomy, producing self-determined ideals In other words, the things which are greatest, the things which we should aspire to, are determined by you and me. That's what autonomy does. As opposed, so you have culture defined in that way, as opposed to recognizing any sense of a transcendent reality, as opposed to searching for and discovering some truly ideal and eternal realities. Now, listen carefully to this. I want you to hear the comment from one of our current Supreme Court justices, Justice Kennedy, and he wrote this as part of the rationale for his ruling. I don't even remember the ruling. The ruling is irrelevant. I promise. Quote, "At the very heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life," end quote. Now think about that for a moment. That's absurd. That's philosophically absurd. There are givens about this world. They're not givens because you or I pronounce them as givens. They're givens because they're given. Yes, they just are. They just are. And they are no matter what we call them, right? They're just givens. And so it's absurd to think or to have a philosophy like Justice Kennedy here is articulating. But, by golly, that's the dominant attitude around us a lot today. This philosophy of life means that we have been loosed from any common, even if ill-defined. I'm not saying the truth. I'm saying some kind of common notion of creaturely dependence upon the divine without anything to replace it. Just cut the tether, let the ship go, come what may. At least nothing to hold it and give it stability other than ourselves and our own notions of what is good. Thus, there is nothing to provide stability and a common understanding of what constitutes a good and just and righteous society. Now, that's what we all want, isn't it? A just and righteous and good society. At some point, autonomous definitions of justice and goodness come into conflict with one another, and certainly with definitions which reject autonomy or relativity, and the results cannot endure. Remember that quotation I read earlier by Michael Mead. So the tensions between Christ and culture or Christian presence and culture are diverse and complex. But from a Christian perspective, they find their origin in the stubborn refusal of human beings made in God's image to acknowledge creaturely dependence on their maker. Now that's not even theologically hard to swallow, is it? I mean, sure, there are plenty who can't, but some kind of dependence beyond ourselves, surely. This goes back to what we call the fall, that original rebellion and refusal to acknowledge creaturely dependence. However, these tensions and complexities, now hear me clearly on this too, these tensions and complexities are not resolved when such dependence upon the divine is acknowledged. That doesn't solve all the problems of how to understand the world. Let's not be naive. And this is true for several reasons, epistemic reasons, anthropological reasons, etc., etc. But I would argue that central to this conundrum is what theologians call total depravity. The heart and soul of our very being has been marred by that rebellion, and we cannot purely see or know. As the Apostle Paul says, we see through a glass darkly. Now, while confessing Christ as Lord is the proper, from a Christian perspective, and fundamental starting point, we still have to interpret and understand him. How did he act? What were his priorities? What was and is his mission? He lived and worked in particular cultures, more than one. How did he understand his own person and work in relation to the world, and thus in relation to culture? He was both affirming and disruptive, which was he at certain times. Sometimes it's hard to tell. And how do we apply that to our own lives or our personal present circumstances? You see, just by acknowledging our dependence upon God and an affirmation, an embrace of Christ, doesn't solve these kinds of issues. In fact, I have said before that in spite of typical evangelical affirmation that Jesus is the answer, I beg to differ. I think Jesus is the problem. Because even when I trust him, I'm left with a lot of questions and challenges. And he calls me to something very different than what my desiring heart, my yearning soul, and my reasoning mind apart from him wants. You see, I have to be transformed. I have to be remolded, remade. And that doesn't happen just by saying, God, I'm a sinner. I need your help. And that's what I did one day, and that's how my transformation began. But that was only the first step. That brings us to formative education. So I'm two-thirds of the way through. Formation, now hear me clearly, formation is inevitable in every situation. Every school, as you all know, we are a Christian school across the street from two public schools. You will never hear me talk about formation happening in our school, but not across the street. That's foolish, because formation is happening over there. Formation is always happening. Remember the comments about how while we create culture, we create and shape culture, more often culture creates and shapes us? That's true. And it's true even in education. So we don't have a monopoly, we don't have the corner on formation. But we're very intentional and upfront about the kind of formation we're after, how we think we ought to go about it, and what are the fundamental non-negotiables that must underlie it. Ah, is that what we mean by properly formative education? So formation is inevitable. In any and every circumstance and context, formation is happening. This is why parents must be very careful about the educational context in which they place their children. That context is shaping their children. The unstated curriculum of any school is often the most profoundly formative. So I'm using formation here in a technical sense to refer to an intentional telos. Telos is the ancient Greek word which means goal or purpose, that target. That's our telos, not that, Mr. Baxter, but that target up there, right? Progressive and contemporary education, of course, claims to be morally neutral, though such a notion is self-defeating and absurd. There is nothing that's morally neutral. Period. And progressive and modern education is characterized by a set of pragmatic commitments which are socially and economically oriented, because they are useful skills for an economically stable life. There's nothing wrong with that. Again, I would support vocational education in certain respects. I would. I do. But let's call it what it is. And that's something less than what I mean tonight by properly formative education. Not properly in the sense that it's the only way to do it. Not properly in the sense that it's the only important way to do it, but properly in the sense of the kind of telos that the conversation of the ages has identified as central to what it means to be humans, living, shaping, and being a part of a just and good society. Classical education, sometimes referred to as liberal education in the classical sense, is a more complete and truer education in that it gets to the heart of humanity, the world, and respective purposes, rather than secondary stuff, which is becoming much more increasingly known and performed by AI, artificial intelligence. John Paul II, in the opening to his Fidei et Ratio, beautifully noted that, quote, faith and reason are like two wings on which the human spirit rises to the contemplation of truth, end quote. Yes and amen, but I would say in one sense, not enough. As argued eloquently by the European philosopher Michael Polanyi, all knowledge is personal knowledge, which means relational knowledge. Even the notions of faith and reason that John Paul II mentioned, these are relational realities. These are personal realities. Thus, what I'm saying is that properly formative education revolves around what it means to be human and constitutes, and thus what constitutes a just and humane society. The great tradition from which properly formative education drinks deeply makes this abundantly clear in several ways. If we go back to Aristotle and his discussion of the four causes behind pretty much anything, and if you want to really understand something, you must understand its four causes. How does this apply to education? Well, the formal cause behind it is the ideal of what you're trying to bring about. I would describe that as men and women of knowledge, understanding, skill, and virtue. That's what we're aiming at. What is the material cause? Ah, now here's where it gets a little tricky, because most people are going to think the material cause, and this is in fact a very modern notion, the material cause is the curriculum. That's what we use to educate. I would disagree very strongly. The material cause is the student, the disciple. We're not educating ideas. We're not educating books. We're not educating curriculum. We're educating students. And it is people, not books, not ideas. It is people who live the kind of life I've tried to describe here. And so that's the material cause. What is the efficient cause? What brings it about? Ah, that's where the books come in. No. The efficient cause is teachers and mentors. Remember, it must be a relational reality, a personal reality. And that relational reality uses impersonal means like books, nowadays, calculators, rulers, pencils and pens, chalk, whiteboards, dry erase markers, computers, PowerPoint, all those dastardly things. But the efficient cause is not those things. The efficient cause is people, mentors, and teachers. What's the final cause? Lives of harmony with truth, goodness, and beauty, bearing most completely the image and purposes for which we were created. Putting the matter another way, the final cause is the recognition and development of a life in which one believes rightly, lives properly, perceives others truthfully, and gives sound direction to the intentions of one's own heart. That's a properly formed person. Now, who among us do not want that? Now, I'm not saying we agree on what is the right thing to believe, but hopefully if we've done our work well, there's enough overlap there that we can coexist without conflict. But every parent wants a child who's described in that way, in some manner. Genuine or true education is engaged in the formation of young men and women to know and conform to truth. While this includes the acquisition of information and the development of skills, it is more fundamentally concerned with the development of a divinely sanctioned way of being. In other words, going back to those givens to the degree that we can ascertain them. What it means to be human and to contribute to a just and healthy culture. We will conclude where all things ultimately end, namely, Christ is Lord. Historical, social, psychological, theological, philosophical, biblical assessments, when carried out in a very, very, very healthy manner, lead to that end, I think. Remember the famous dictum by C.S. Lewis? After looking very, very, very carefully at the Gospels, he said, look, I can't help but conclude we have one of three choices. This mysterious figure named Jesus was either a liar, a lunatic, or Lord. And of course, he ultimately confessed that he is Lord. Jesus Christ, the eternal Logos, the eternal word of truth, the creator of all that is, the arbiter of all that is true, good, and beautiful, the ultimate subject of all properly ordered adoration, affection, worship, and desire. He is the preeminent one. All else which he created is in some way a reflection of him. All learning is truncated and stunted if it does not emanate from him and or lead to him. Romans 12, 1 and 2. Present your bodies as living sacrifices. And then he goes on to say, most translations translate it, and do not be conformed to this world. Read there this culture. Actually, the Greek text is more powerful than that. What Paul says is, stop being conformed to this culture, this world. You see, Paul too understood that if we're not careful, we are shaped and created more deeply ourselves by culture than we are shaping and creating it. And so Paul says very explicitly, stop being conformed to this culture and be transformed. How do you do that? By the renewing of your minds. Then 2 Peter, referred to with our faith and culture speaker this year, to your faith, add virtue, to your virtue, add knowledge, and then Peter goes on from there. That's a good description of what I've been arguing for. Faith, virtue, knowledge, and then on it goes. Conclusion, the goal is to discover and bring truth to bear in our lives and in our broader culture. To discover and embrace non-negotiables, a guiding paradigm, a story, a meta-narrative, if you will, by which we ought, notice how I said that, ought to live. At various times and in various ways, this will give rise to what Dreher called a parallel polis, sometimes enhancing and sometimes confronting the dominant culture. We must avoid the trap succinctly articulated by Michael Horton. Instead of being in the world but not of it, which is, of course, what the Bible calls us to, we easily become of the world but not in it. In other words, we pull back from it, but yet we're really still characterized by it. We refuse to engage it. How do we do that? Knowledge, understanding, discernment, wisdom, virtue. How do we get those? Properly formative education. What is that? It's the discovery of these non-negotiables, these first principles of life, of virtue and her ways and her reasons. This, of course, brings us back to where we began a moment ago. Christ is Lord, the eternal Logos, from whom emanates all that is right and true and beautiful, the very realities to which properly formative education leads, and thus why it is so desperately needed, not only in our culture, but in every culture. Thank you very much.